Welcome to College Land, a podcast featuring untold stories from higher education. I'm Nan Enstad in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Lisa Levenstein in Greensboro, North Carolina. We're here to explore life inside of our nation's colleges and universities and to track some of the major changes that are happening.
We do this by sharing stories about the people who work there.
Today on our show, we'll talk some more about why we started this podcast, and then we'll share an interview I did with Dia Abdo, talking about a refugee resettlement program that she founded at Guilford College in North Carolina. In the past 5 years, the Every Campus a Refuge program has hosted 45 refugees in Guilford College campus houses and apartments and helped them settle and grow acquainted with the surrounding community.
We will end with a segment we call Extra Credit, in which we offer our recommendations for cool stuff if you want to look into these issues further. If you have an idea for this segment or for any of our segments, we want to hear from you. Our email is collegelandpod@gmail.com. You can also reach us on Twitter at collegelandpod. Now on to our show. You know, Lisa, I want to talk a little bit about why we decided to emphasize work on this College Land podcast. We're interviewing people about the work they do on campus, paid or unpaid, and using these stories as the touchstone for our conversation, which will be ongoing.
You know, a big advantage of this approach is that we get to discover what's going on in the vast ecosystem of higher education. There's so many colleges, and many of them are like small cities unto themselves. Plus, these colleges are not some ivory tower set apart from real life. And we're really interested in looking at the ways that these colleges connect the lives of ordinary people. There are an estimated 5,300 universities and colleges across the country, and those range from large flagship campuses to community colleges. Think about it. Nearly every city, small town, and even rural area has a college campus in their community or nearby.
And the university system taken together is a big employer. Colleges employ about 3 million people. There are professors and lecturers, chef and food staff, housekeeping workers, librarians and museum curators, healthcare professionals, counselors, and academic advisors.
I know, dig around on any large campus, and I guarantee you're going to find people doing things that you didn't know about. I've seen community organizers, horticultural scientists, water quality experts, music composers, and even ice cream flavor innovators. And we really want to hear their stories about life on campus.
Plus, students do all kinds of paid and unpaid work on campus, work that affects the community they live in. Our voting rights episode is based on an interview with a student who worked on the 2020 presidential election Get Out the Vote campaign.
Listeners, if you know of someone working on a college campus that you'd like to see us cover, or if you're associated with a college campus and have your own story to tell, we want to hear from you. Email us at collegelandpod@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at collegelandpod. Now on to our interview. Our segment today features Dia Abdo, who started the Every Campus a Refuge program to host refugee families at a small liberal arts college in Greensboro, North Carolina. You know, Nan, this conversation really challenged me to think in new ways about the role campuses should play in our common lives. So let's listen. Dia Abdo, welcome to College Land.
Thanks for having me.
You grew up in Jordan, the daughter of Palestinian immigrants. How did that experience shape your career?
I think it shaped it in stages and in ways I wasn't aware of until I came to the U.S. So growing up, the daughter of Palestinian refugees, and I was raised by my grandmother who fled Palestine with her children, I think in many ways it influenced how deeply I connected to the Palestinian identity and Palestine as a homeland. And I think that later manifests itself in the U.S. as something I returned to, right? So it was embedded in me, this desire to speak about, to think about, to write about, to speak to the Palestinian experience. But, you know, raised in Jordan, which is formerly a British mandate, and the school that I went to very much steeped in sort of the colonial British legacy, So much of what I learned and read and studied about was European. And so for the longest time, I was really invested in British and American literature. And so I think growing up in Jordan, in a country very much idolizing the British and the West, it was very dichotomous, right? So a part of me was deeply connected to my Palestinianness. And I think another part of me was looking westward. Later on, when I came to the U.S., I think those two dichotomous parts would sort of be in tension with each other until I was able to balance them out.
Can you talk about how you did some of that in your career at Guilford?
Mm-hmm. So as a professor of English at Guilford College, I was teaching in the English department, but I was the professor who was really working with sort of global literatures, post-colonial literatures. I teach Arab women writers, Arab American women writers, Arab and Islamic feminisms, world literature, refugee and immigrant literature. And so even though as an undergraduate, I studied British and American literature, later on in my career, I went back to really what spoke to me in terms of my identity early on in life and focused a lot more on women writers, feminists from my part of the world, women who look like me and talk like me and care about things that I care about.
Tell us about how you got the idea for Every Campus a Refuge.
In 2015, and I think a lot of people remember this, this was sort of the height of the Syrian civil war and the refugee crisis. And in that summer, there were many distressing, tragic incidents where refugees were escaping and not surviving. They were drowning in their journeys in dinghies and boats. They were perishing on long journeys. And there was one particular case in which a young child, his name is Aylan Kurdi, who was crossing from Turkey with his mother and his little brother, and they drowned, and his body washed up on a shore in Turkey and was captured by a photographer. His body looked like a sleeping child. And that particular image really mobilized, it moved the world, and it moved many of us because it was special, right? It spoke to millions who all of a sudden, I guess, realized what the Syrian refugee crisis was doing. And at the time, Pope Francis called on every parish in Europe to host a refugee family as a response to this tragic sight. And it occurred to me when he said that it was really just such a brilliant idea to think about small communities, small cities, small places as accountable, right? As places that can and should participate in hospitality. And I thought, well, a college or university campus is exactly like that. It's like a parish, like a small city. We have everything that you need to be able to support a family. Indeed, we do this every year for hundreds of students, right? We have housing, we have cafeterias, we have clinics, we have human resources, material resources, gyms, you know, galleries, career centers. So it made perfect sense for me to sort of respond to the Pope's call and say, yes, college and university campuses should heed that call and host refugee families.
This is such a radical reimagining of what a college campus can be. Why do you think we don't typically think of the university in this way, and what kinds of things open up for us when we start to envision the campus as a mini city, as you say, that has massive amounts of human and material resources that can be put to ends that both help the educational mission and augment it?
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to think that it's radical, not in the sense that it's extreme, but radical in the sense that it brings us back to the roots, right, of community. And really, it's not extreme or radical at all. It's again, we do this all the time. But we do it for students, we do it for faculty members, we do it for visiting scholars, we do it for visiting parents, we do it for study abroad students. So we do it for people all the time. I think we think of it as radical because it inverts what we think campuses should do, right? We should send people out into the world to do good. We don't see ourselves necessarily as a place where we can bring our community in. And so if there's anything strange or radical about it, is that it's really blurring the boundaries and the barriers between what our city is and what our community is and who we are as a campus, and reframing for whom a campus is supposed to be safe, right? So I keep saying that one of the things that inspired me is the Arabic word for campus, which is haram. And haram means a sanctuary, a place of refuge. And indeed, sort of in the public imaginary, at least for me growing up, I always knew that a university or college campus is a place that's safe. It's a place that's safe for students. It's a place where people can express radical ideas and be protected, right? It's a place where people can be free to say and do the things that they want to say and do. And that's why we're shocked when police go on campus, when people are injured on campus, right? It's this place that we find our security. And I think what we need to do is reframe for whom that safety should be. It should be for all of us, right? And it should be for all of our community members. And so I think if there's anything radical about it, because really in terms of practicality, it is not radical. It is a basic idea that simply says, let's do what we do for our college and university communities for our neighbors, right? Let's do that for them. I think what's radical about it is that we're letting people in. We're not simply sending people out.
Can you take us through that process of bringing people in, what it entailed at Guilford when you first started the endeavor, how students and faculty were involved in the effort?
Sure. So once I got this idea, I think several things happened. First of all, I thought, well, how can I bring this to the Guilford community? And because I was at Guilford, which is a small liberal arts Quaker school, there was a lot already in Guilford's history and ethos that lent itself to that proposal. As you might know, and folks might know, Guilford College sits on an old growth woods that was part of the Underground Railroad. And so it's sort of in our history, our Quaker history, that the surrounding Quakers would help the slaves who were hiding in the woods escape and were smuggling them up north. And so in a way, Guilford physically, spatially, had a history of refuge, right? But in addition to that, the Quaker testimonies, especially of stewardship, that we are responsible for our resources, we are responsible to use them in ways that are right and just and good, in ways that are aligned with our stated values. And for Guilford College as a Quaker institution, as a liberal arts institution, you know, our values are ones of equity and diversity and justice, and all of those things align with this effort, right? If we were a refuge at one point, we can be so again. And so I think one way to do this is to think about the culture, the history of the campus and the college, and to see how an effort like this could best be framed. And so it was easy for me really to go to the president and say, look, we're a Quaker institution. We've done this before. We continue to do it for, different kinds of communities who need us intermittently. Why don't we dedicate a house on our campus to host a refugee family? And so once she said yes, really, it took off from there. I connected with a local refugee resettlement agency who we partnered with as co-sponsors. And for 5 years now, we've been hosting refugees on Guilford College's campus. 60 so far, half of them have been children. They stay on our campus for a period of time, and we support them in a variety of ways.
Could you maybe take us through the process by giving us an example of one of the families that you've hosted?
Yes, absolutely. So I want to say that we host families who come from Syria, from Iraq, from the DRC, from Rwanda, from Sudan, from Uganda. We're currently hosting a family from Venezuela and Colombia. So we've hosted families who have come from all over the world and have experienced different cultures. They come from a different background, speak different languages, practice different faiths, and they have all obviously the commonness of, or the common factor of fleeing persecution, right? That's what, that's why they are refugees, and that's why they are seeking safety elsewhere. And so I think what, there are so many families that we've hosted who are truly memorable. I think one good example for me is the Iraqi family that we hosted. We hosted on our campus in 2017. So it's been 3 years now. And the father in that family, Ali al-Khazraji, is a calligraphist and an artist. And I think he is a perfect example, as has been the case with many of the families that we've hosted, in showcasing why campuses are perfect for this, right? Because like a small city, we have every resource that you can think of. And so when we're hosting an artist, we can say, we have studio space that you can use. We have art supplies that you can use. And when you're done with your work, we have a gallery where we can exhibit your work, which is what happened. And Ali is now producing artwork, and his art was picked up by a gallery downtown, which is wonderful. And so I think it's an example of how something like this can support refugee resettlement efforts in allowing families and individuals to thrive rather than simply survive, right? When we put our bodies on the line, when we put our space on the line, our resources on the line, we can make a huge difference in the ways that these families experience refuge, in the ways that they experience resettlement. It's suddenly not simply about finding any job, right, or finding any apartment, but making a life for yourself and a life worth living.
How are the students and the faculty involved in this effort?
In a variety of ways. They're the backbone of this, right? So initially, they were involved by saying yes, right? So when I brought this proposal to the campus, dozens of us collectively said, yes, we want to do this. Yes, we want to be a campus refuge. Yes, we want to host refugee families. So just in terms of advocacy, activism, being on board, that was huge. And then we built sort of a collective of volunteers over the years. We have over 120 vetted and trained volunteers who come from our student body, from our staff, from our faculty, from our community. And so they provide services, direct services and services to the program as volunteers, and programmatically also they're involved. And then eventually I developed a curricular component. And so faculty and staff are invested and interested in a variety of curricular and co-curricular ways, whether it's teaching classes, developing assignments, conducting research, creating material to support the effort. I like to think of every campus a refuge, and I've said this often, as an asset-based community of practice, right? And so if you've got an asset, I can use it. And so you can imagine on a campus where we've got hundreds of people with hundreds of different kinds of skills and assets that cut across disciplines. Everybody is involved in the way that they would like to be involved, but in a way that respects the dignity and safety and privacy of our families and their needs.
Can you talk a little bit more about that last point, which I think is so critical and such an important part of the work that you've done? It's not a kind of helping model, but one of collaboration and respect, really. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about how that's really woven in to the DNA of what this project is about.
Thank you. Yes, I think I like that phrase, that it's woven into the DNA. It's from the inception, right? It was very clear that if we do this, we do this because we are accountable for doing this. So remember when I said earlier, Guilford College, in its history, is a place of refuge, but also in its history is a place of segregation, right? We did not have African-American students until the 1960s. In North Carolina, we are sitting on the lands of dispossessed and displaced individuals, right? People are seeking refuge all over the world and seeking safety because of policies and practices that this country and others have engaged in. So we have facilitated the departure of many communities, and we are accountable to creating spaces that support them as a result of the practices that we have inherited, as a result of the policies that we've inherited. So I think framing it very early on as accountability and responsibility rather than charity, right, is pivotal. And then having conversations before we even designed anything. So yes, we got the house, but then the first thing I did after that was go to the Refugee Resettlement Agency, whose staff are predominantly local refugees and immigrants, and said, what do you all need? And so listening to the community and seeing what it is that folks who are coming here as newcomers, what do they need? What do they want? Right? So framing our effort around their needs, designing our efforts around their needs, aligning our efforts with their needs rather than saying, well, here's what we want to do, right? And then you can take it or leave it. But making sure that we design something that aligns with the needs of the community is essential. And so what rose to the top was the need for housing and material and cultural support, because the Refugee Resettlement Program in the U.S. Allows for a very short period of time and a very limited stipend for newcomers to achieve self-sufficiency. So I think what I want to say in a nutshell is that in everything that we do, we center the needs of the newcomers. We center the experiences of the hosted families. And I tell folks that when this started with, this was never for or about the students, right? This was always for and about the newcomers that we would be hosting on our campus. And so that is embedded in the ethos of the program. As the program developed, we made sure that in our best practices that was upheld. So volunteers were always vetted to make sure that they were qualified to do the work of direct services, that they signed confidentiality agreement, that they would not be taking pictures and posting pictures on their social media, that they would not be sharing private information, that they would not be talking about folks in, you know, conversations with others, that anything that we did in the curriculum did not ever include the folks that we hosted on our campus as educational material, right? The folks that we host on our campus are not resources to be mined by our students. We are there to do a job, right? Folks need someone to take them to the DSS to help them fill out a form. That's what we do. And so really focusing on the services, the direct services aspect of it, and the privacy and the confidentiality and the choices that the folks that we host on our campus make. This is really also very much about choice. The Refugee Resettlement Program, the way it's structured here, welcomes folks and then sets them up in a house, not of their choosing, because they arrive and they're immediately taken to that house. And then folks have to sort of accept the first job that they get. Every campus or refuge allows them to get to know Greensboro first so that they can make a choice about where they'd like to live and what community they'd like to be in. And so I think in every step of the way, centering choice, centering dignity, centering privacy is key.
You're really continuing some of this work now in a new position that you have as the director of the Center for New North Carolinians, which is part of a different educational institution. It's part of UNC Greensboro. But here again, I'm struck by how the sites that you are working in kind of challenge or complicate our understanding of what a university is. So we think about universities having a nursing school, a business school, schools of education. We don't necessarily think about them having a center for new immigrants, right? So why did UNCG feel that it was important to establish this kind of center as part of an educational institution?
Right. That's a great question. And I think it happens because of individuals who are invested in these issues. And so the Center for North Carolinians was founded 20 years ago by individuals who are invested in the health and the well-being of Greensboro's various communities. And it really evolved as part of initially personal and individual and then collective efforts to support newcomers, especially the earliest newcomers, the refugees in the 1980s, the Montagnards, and then later on the different populations and newcomers and immigrants who came to Greensboro over the last 40 years. And so very much like every campus of refuge, I think it begins with individuals. And I want to put this out there because I want your listeners to hear that one person, two people can make a huge difference, right? And it can develop and evolve into something longstanding like the CNNC, which has been around for 20 years, founded by one professor but then taken on by many others, many other staff members, to serve over 2,000 individuals a year through a variety of programs and be supported by UNCG. And I hope that folks hear that and think that they can make a big difference by taking on something like this and really institutionalizing it. I think that's key, right? Thinking about how to institutionalize these efforts. So every campus of refuge is very much institutionalized in the curriculum, in our service learning efforts at Guilford College. And now the CNNC is part of the Office of Research and Engagement. We're sort of connected by a variety of tentacles in UNCG, whether it's courses, whether it's programs, and then of course with our connections and partnerships with grantors and funders and various nonprofit organizations and agencies in Greensboro.
Dee Abdo, thank you for this incredible work that you've done now on two college campuses in Greensboro and for being such an inspiring member of the community. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Thank you.
Oh, you know, Lisa, I love this interview. And what really stands out to me as powerful is this sense of college campuses not defined by austerity, as we've been so used to hearing about lately, but generosity. And austerity in this case isn't juxtaposed with wealth. It's not like Dia is saying, hey, you know, money bags Guilford College, pony up. You know, she's saying colleges can be accountable. They are part of their communities. They can step up and provide hospitality to refugees because they're part of the community that we live in. I find that just very inspiring.
And I love that duality that she emphasized. On the one hand, colleges as embedded in a larger community, but also colleges as cities unto themselves that have everything a person could need. I hadn't thought of it in that way when you think about the housing, the food, but then also that fabulous story about the calligrapher who was given studio space to work on his art and then was able to exhibit it and really develop his craft. I had never thought about the role of the arts on college campuses, which are so important, but I hadn't thought about them in that way until I heard Dia tell those stories.
Yeah, like I'm more familiar with churches and synagogues being foundations for refugees into a community. And that's wonderful. I applaud them. But it's true that they don't have all of those. They have some of those resources, but not all of those resources at their disposal. And it makes so much sense for a college campus to step up in this way.
And what I loved about the way that Every Campus a Refuge program was stepping up was that it was doing it based on principles of accountability and responsibility rather than charity. There was this really deeply ingrained respect for the individuality of the people they were housing and their kind of common humanity. And this kind of emphasis that Dia was emphasizing on putting their needs as the priority. These aren't people being brought in to give students really cool new experiences interacting with refugees, right? These are people that Guilford College has a responsibility towards and that Guilford College is putting their needs first in the services and support that it's offering.
If I were a student on that campus, though, and I knew about the refugee program, I would be learning a lot about this just from having this modeled, you know, having this kind of responsibility and accountability modeled.
Absolutely. Without a doubt, the students there must be getting so much out of it. I mean, the way that they're being trained in, you know, in advance and just the learning experience of being on a campus with these refugee families that are changing over time. I think it's just extraordinary.
I was also really struck by how when you said, this is kind of radical, she's like, you know, it's not radical. It's only radical in terms of going to the root. And it really made me think about the politics here. This issue has been increasingly politicized during the Trump campaign, when basically there's been a concerted attack on refugees and on the very status that refugees are supposed to have under the United Nations. But it hasn't always been so politicized. And what I hear Dia saying is we need to not politicize this issue. Human rights should transcend politics. And I know that even after 4 years of divisive and hateful rhetoric, many Republicans still believe that the United States has to accept refugees. The Pew Foundation did a study, and 25% of Republicans believe that the United States has a responsibility to accept refugees. And in January 2020, Republican governors defied Trump and said that their states would accept refugees. So this is really a changing landscape right now. And I think it's important for us to think carefully about where do we want colleges and universities to land on this issue? Okay, kind listeners, now it's time for Extra Credit, in which we offer our recommendations for fun and cool things related to our topic. And today our topic is refugees.
My extra credit is the Netflix comedy series One Day at a Time. It's based on a 1970s sitcom, but it's been updated for the 21st century. And the series fits with the themes of our show today because it features a Cuban-American family, and almost every episode touches in some way on their relationship to their Cuban identities. Penelope, the mother, is a nurse who served in the army. Her teenage daughter is a budding feminist and leftist activist who can be hilariously hardcore. And her son is a bridge builder who has a big heart and wants to be cool. I think the funniest character is Penelope's mother, who lives with them and is a constant reminder of their Cuban heritage. The show explores serious issues like racial profiling, the struggles of undocumented people, and cultural displacement, but it does it in really honest and I find quite moving ways. What I love about it is that it also is just really funny, and it celebrates Cuban culture, particularly music and dance. You know, I have teenage children, and it can be pretty hard for us to find shows to watch together, but we all enjoy One Day at a Time. What's your extra credit, Nan?
So my recommendation is a book called A is for Asylum Seeker, Words for People on the Move. It's written by Rachel Buff. Its Spanish translation, which is on Facing Pages, is by Alejandra Oliva, and it's published by Fordham University Press in 2020. So this is a really cool book that is basically written as a glossary. This is not an academic book, y'all. It has a bunch of entries of just a few pages each, all about words that have become supercharged in our national immigration policy debate. So words like asylum seeker, refugee, undocumented immigrant, deportee. If you want to know, like, what do these words mean? What are the contests around what these words mean? This is a book for you. Every entry starts with a little story that illuminates competing uses of the words and then explains kind of what's going on and how to understand the history. So this would be of interest to anyone who wants to get a better handle on immigration politics today.
And that's our show for today. We want to hear from you. Send us your questions and ideas for segment to collegelandpod@gmail.com or reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at collegelandpod.
Thanks to our producer, the wonderful Rochelle Wilson, and to Wisconsin Humanities for their support. Thanks for visiting College Land. Come back again soon.